You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN Energy's daily blog, the oil and gas industry's go-to source for insight. Every day, we cover commodity fundamentals, industry changes, and developing trends across energy markets. And now, we're making it easier than ever to enjoy our blogs. Whether it's on your drive into work, while you're at the office, or at home walking the dog, settle in, turn the volume up, and enjoy.
Sunday, June 20th, 2021. The Air That I Breathe, Part 3. The U.S.'s Existing and Planned CO2 Pipeline Networks. Published by Housley Carr. Using carbon dioxide for enhanced oil recovery offers tremendous potential for CO2 sequestration. The problem is, most of the CO2 used in EOR today is produced from natural underground sources, only to be piped to EOR sites and put underground again. Realizing the full promise of CO2 for EOR would require sourcing more and more anthropogenic CO2, or ACO2, in other words, man-made CO2 that is captured from power generation and industrial processes. In addition to the environmental benefits, there are two other drivers for making this switch from natural CO2 to ACO2. The first is that some of the natural sources of CO2 used today for EOR are dwindling, and the second is that the push to sequester man-made CO2 is backed by tax credits and other government-backed incentives. No matter the CO2 sourcing, CO2 for EOR requires pipelines to transport the CO2 from where it is produced to EOR sites. Today, we continue our series on the rapidly evolving CO2 market and the huge opportunities that may await those who pursue them. When we first started posting our daily blog many, many moons ago, our unshakable focus was on hydrocarbons and the interrelationships between the crude oil, natural gas, and NGL markets. Life was so simple then. But more recently, the energy industry has begun to undergo massive change, and lately the pace of that change has been accelerating and the trajectory and target have become crystal clear. Like it or not, we're headed toward a lower carbon world, and players in the hydrocarbon sector can either figure out how to participate in, and hopefully benefit from, the upheavals that are occurring or watch from the sidelines. As for us, we prefer to be engaged and to learn, and to try to foresee how the energy transition getting underway in earnest will unfold, and how the role of hydrocarbons will evolve as it does. Toward that end, in addition to our blogs about crude oil production, LNG exports, steam cracking margins, gasoline demand, and similar topics, we've been blogging a lot more in recent months about things like the ESG movement, the prospects for producing hydrogen for use as a fuel, low-carbon fuel standards, renewable diesel, and, in this series, the huge potential for sequestering carbon dioxide through enhanced oil recovery, or EOR. As we said in Part 1, CO2 sequestration is the permanent storage of CO2 deep below ground in permeable rock formations, oil and gas reservoirs, saline formations, coal seams, etc. If the CO2 is captured and stored, and that's all, the process is called CCS, or carbon capture and storage. On the other hand, if the CO2 is used for some other process before it's stored, it is called CCUS, or carbon capture, use, and storage. EOR is a form of CCUS, and a very economic one at that. In EOR, CO2 is pumped into the production zone of an old, exhausted oil field. It mixes with the oil that has been left behind, combines with the oil so that it swells and flows better, and helps push that oil toward the producing wells, in effect breathing new life into otherwise depleted fields. Some of the CO2 used in this process stays underground, permanently trapped in the reservoir. The rest of the CO2 comes out of the ground mixed with the oil, then is separated and recycled back into the field, a process that goes on until all the original CO2 used is trapped underground. We also pointed out the paradox that while the CO2 stored underground in the U.S. through EOR accounts for most of the CO2 sequestered globally, much of the CO2 used for EOR in the U.S. is tapped from natural CO2 reservoirs and piped to oil fields for use in EOR. In other words, it's taken out of the ground to be put back in the ground, with no net impact on U.S. CO2 emissions. Switch to ACO2 as the source, though, and expanded use of EOR could have a game-changing impact. EOR has the potential to sequester a half century or more of U.S. CO2 emissions at their current rate, and even more if that emissions rate is reduced. In Part 2, we did deep dives both on how the CO2 EOR process works and on the economics driving the use of the process. Today, we shift our focus to CO2 sourcing and the transportation of CO2 to EOR sites. The topic is obviously important because without CO2 delivered to the well, there's no CO2 EOR. There are more than 5,000 miles of CO2 pipeline in the U.S. owned by 29 companies, the leaders in CO2 pipelines being Kinder Morgan Denbury Resources and Occidental Petroleum, or Oxy. The vast majority of the U.S.'s existing CO2 pipelines are located within four broad regions, the Permian, the Rockies, the Gulf Coast, and the Mid-Continent. A number of initiatives are underway to capture, gather CO2 and pipe it to underground sequestration sites, without using it for EOR, that is. We show a couple of the big ones on the map. The first of these is the plan by a partnership of Valero Energy, a BlackRock Energy Fund, and Navigator Energy Services to develop a 1,200-mile CO2 pipeline system in the Midwest that will transport CO2 captured at eight Valero ethanol plants to a sequestration site in south-central Illinois. The second is ExxonMobil's proposed Houston CCS Innovation Zone, which would involve capturing all the CO2 from petrochemical, manufacturing, and power generation facilities along the Houston Ship Channel, aggregating that CO2 into a common hub, transporting it on a pipeline out into the Gulf of Mexico, and then pumping it into geologic formations thousands of feet under the seafloor. We will be getting back with details on those projects in future episodes of this blog series, along with an overview of each of the regional CO2 pipeline networks. But today we'll begin a deep dive into the largest CO2 network of all, the one serving the Permian, whose infrastructure and CO2 EOR activity far exceed those of the other regions. As noted above, most of the CO2 used for EOR in the Permian comes from natural sources of CO2, with the vast majority provided by three major sources in Colorado and northeastern New Mexico. About 2,600 miles of pipelines transport the CO2 from those distant sites to the Permian. The largest CO2 source is McElmo Dome and its smaller cousin Doe Canyon, both located in southwestern Colorado. McElmo is a deep CO2 reservoir at about 9,700 feet, which means the CO2 comes out of the ground at high pressures. These days it produces about 750 million cubic feet per day, which is down about 400 million cubic feet per day since 2019. We understand that there are enough CO2 reserves in McElmo at current production rates to keep it going for another 10 to 20 years, if demand for natural CO2 holds up in the future, which is unlikely if, as expected, CO2 displaces natural CO2 in EOR. The CO2 from McElmo and Doe Canyon is piped long distance on Kinder Morgan's 502-mile, 1.5 BCF per day Cortez pipeline to Denver City, Texas, the larger of the Permian's two hubs for distributing CO2. There's an extensive CO2 distribution system that fans out from the Denver City hub. Then there's the Sheep Mountain CO2 sourcing site in south-central Colorado, which we understand is currently shut in. It is connected to the Denver City hub by Oxy's 408-mile, 590 million cubic feet per day Sheep Mountain pipeline. The other large CO2 source for the Permian is Bravo Dome, located in northeastern New Mexico. It is much closer to the surface than McElmo, at only about 3,000 feet deep, requires a lot of compressor horsepower to get the CO2 out of the ground, since it does not have much natural pressure, and only produces about 190 million cubic feet per day of CO2. Bravo was producing about 260 million cubic feet per day in 2017. It is likely that Bravo has only about another 5 years or so of production at current rates, which is a good reason for bringing in CO2 to the fields currently supplied by the Dome. Bravo is linked to Denver City by Oxy, Kinder Morgan, and XTO Energy's jointly owned 218-mile, 380 million cubic feet per day Bravo pipeline. The second, smaller CO2 hub in the Permian is near McCamey, Texas, which receives CO2 that is separated and captured at Oxy's Century Natural Gas Processing Plant via the company's 25-mile, 110 million cubic feet per day Century pipeline and CO2 from five smaller gas processing plants collectively known as the Val Verde plants via the 83-mile, 110 million cubic feet per day Val Verde pipeline. Once CO2 reaches either the Denver City or McCamey hub, it is distributed to EOR sites via a number of other pipelines and pipeline systems, a few of them quite large. These include Kinder Morgan's 143-mile, 600 million cubic feet per day Central Basin system, which connects to both the Denver City and McCamey hubs and has several spurs that deliver CO2 to EOR sites in at least 10 counties in West Texas and southeastern New Mexico. Other high-capacity CO2 pipelines out of the two hubs include the following. Number 1. Kinder Morgan's 140-mile, 270 million cubic feet per day Canyon Reef Carriers Pipeline, the oldest CO2 pipeline in Texas, dating from 1972, which transports CO2 from McCamey to the Sacroc, Scurry Area Canyon Reef Operators, Oilfield and Scurry County, Texas. Number 2. Kinder Morgan's 113-mile, 230 million cubic feet per day centerline pipeline, which moves CO2 east from Denver City to the SACROC area, among other points in the Permian's Midland Basin. Number 3. Oxy's 85-mile, 180 million cubic feet per day Estes pipeline, which runs east from Denver City to EOR sites as far away as Kent County, Texas. We're also aware of many other CO2 distribution pipelines in the Permian that either tee off of a major transmission pipeline, such as Trinity Midstream's Llano pipeline off the Cortez pipeline, spoke out from the Denver City hub, such as Trinity Midstream's West Texas pipeline, or extend from other distribution pipelines, such as Kinder Morgan's Eastern Shelf pipeline, which takes CO2 east from the SACROC area. The Permian CO2 pipeline infrastructure is extensive, and is used to distribute vast volumes of both natural CO2 piped in from Colorado and New Mexico and ACO2 separated out and captured from gas processing plants in the Permian. In the next blog in this series, we'll discuss the extraordinary form in which CO2 is transported and used in EOR, namely as a dense phase or supercritical fluid that is neither gas nor liquid, but a strange, almost otherworldly amalgam of both. The Air That I Breathe was written by Albert Hammond and Mike Hazelwood. It originally appeared as the 10th cut on Albert Hammond's 1972 debut album, It Never Rains in Southern California. The album went to number 77 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart. Three singles were released from the LP. The Hollies recorded the song in 1973, and it appears as the fifth song on side one of the Hollies' 14th studio album, Hollies. Recorded at EMI Studio in London in 1973, it was released as a single in the US in March 1974 and went to number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart. Personnel on the record were Alan Clark on lead vocals, Tony Hicks on lead guitar and backing vocals, Terry Sylvester on rhythm guitar and backing vocals, Bobby Elliott on drums, Bernie Calvert on bass and keyboards, and Chris Gunning on orchestral arrangements. In 1992, Radiohead had a hit with Creep, a song with a similar chord progression and melodic content as The Air That I Breathe. The publisher of the older song sued Radiohead and a settlement was reached under which songwriters Hammond and Hazelwood were given co-writing credits and a portion of the royalties. Many artists have covered The Air That I Breathe over the years, including Simply Red, K.D. Lang, Olivia Newton-John, and The Mavericks. The LP Hollies was produced by The Hollies and Ron Richards. Released in March 1974, it went to number 28 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart. The Hollies are a British rock band formed in 1962 in Manchester, England, by Alan Clark and Graham Nash. They, along with the Rolling Stones, are among the few UK rock groups from the early 60s that have never disbanded. The Hollies have released 21 studio albums, 22 compilation albums, 7 EPs, and 67 singles. The band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010. 19 members have passed through the band's ranks since its formation. Original member Tony Hicks and longtime member Bobby Elliott lead a touring version of The Hollies today.
This has been the RBN Energy Blogcast. Thanks for listening.